I just wanted to start things off by asking you if, you know, when you were growing up as a young music fan, if there were any key, like, local record stores or venues. Was there anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah, God. I went to, I lived in Washington, D.C. when I was a kid, and I remember I used to go down to Georgetown. I can't remember what the names of the record stores were down there, but in Georgetown in Washington, D.C., there used to be various, like, secondhand record stores with bins full of LPs that I used to go through, and I was constantly buying secondhand records, so that's part of the reason I'm so excited that the new album is actually on vinyl as well as CD, because I've never had an album on vinyl before, and I still listen to a lot of LPs, so yes. As far as venues go, I remember when I was in college, I went to college just outside Philadelphia, and I remember going to see the Pretenders. I'm trying to remember what the venue was. It was the Pretenders, and in Tuonua were doing support for them. Some venue, and it might have been the Theater of the Living Arts, I'm not sure. But yeah.
Nobody's
ever asked me about that before.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by, like, where people, you know, got started with music and, like, what they were into initially and everything like that. And
yeah.
I just love those, like, communal kind of environments, whether it's, like, a record store or a venue or something like that. It's great. But you touched on something interesting there. We're talking about how excited you were about, you know, finally having a release out and it being on vinyl. So how, you know, direct were you in that process then, like, in as far as, like, creating the gatefold? And, I mean, you had a say in, like, the art and everything like that. So what was it like being involved in that whole process there?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually more involved than I've ever been before in that I actually drew the cover artwork, which I've never done before for any of my albums. I've always got other people to do the artwork. But I had this kind of really precise idea in mind, and I was trying to sketch it out to give to my graphic designer so that she could do the artwork. And I was like, I looked at the sketch and I was like, you know, actually, that's just like my little sketch, but that might be just a fine cover right in itself. And so I think she was kind of pleased because she'd been kind of struggling with the cover of this album. And I said, you know what, I've actually done a little drawing, and I think it might just be a cover. And I sent it to her, and she said, yeah, that'll work. So, and then the gatefold, I mean, I definitely wanted to do a gatefold because I wanted to have all of the lyrics printed out. For me, the lyrics of my songs are really important. And I always do big booklets with CDs. You know, all of my CDs I've done, at least the last few, I've always done like 16-page booklets so that I can print out all of the lyrics. So I didn't want to lose the lyrics by making vinyl. So hence the gatefold. But it's lovely. It's just a great thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big vinyl fan, too. I was just wondering, like, what was it about? Was it just the piece itself? It just felt like it would go great with the, you know, being the cover for this particular release. I'm just wondering maybe why you'd never done that before, sort of thing.
Just never occurred to me. I just never thought of myself. I'd always done drawings. In fact, I illustrated my guitar book, but I guess I never thought of myself as a good enough artist to do my own album artwork. And, you know, I always had people around me whose artwork I really admired, and, you know, thought I'd get them to do album artwork for me. But having sort of dipped my toe in doing it myself, I might keep it up because it just makes the album feel that much more personal to me.
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking. I would imagine you'd be that much more into it, and there would be, you know, that much more autonomy and freedom of you to, like, fully express yourself on a number of levels.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've always had creative autonomy with all of my albums. You know, even when I've worked with, the last few came out on a small label, and not the new one, but the few before that. But even with them, it was always a licensing deal, so I always had total creative control. I do like to work with producers because I feel like producers can really add something creatively to an album and kind of make it better than what you would have done on your own as an artist. You know, there's always something, there's always a level you think you've done the best job you can, and then they say, well, why don't you do this? And you realize, oh yeah, that makes it even better, you know. So
yeah.
So that's the thing I always really like to do. But yeah, definitely with this new album, I think I feel kind of personally closer to it than anything I've ever done before.
Well, I really enjoy hearing that. That's awesome. But speaking about just artistic autonomy in general, I thought it was interesting the landscape we have nowadays, because there's a lot of, you know, freedom to it. You can really express yourself, but there's also that sense of, like, fear of tomorrow. There's not that assured next thing all the time. But ultimately, I would have to imagine it's better than the prior system with, like, a record label where maybe there's some, you know, artistic compromising, even though there's, like, I guess more of, like, that comfortability aspect. So what are your thoughts on the modern landscape in that sense?
Well, I have to contrast myself with Michael Chapman, who produced the new album, and talking with him about his sort of experience of music and what it's been like for him as an artist. His early records were all on major labels, on first Harvest, which was a subsidiary of EMI, and then on Decca. You know, so he always had the label behind him. And one thing I kind of envy about that is he never had to do all of the kind of admin stuff that I have to do as an artist, and that all artists pretty much nowadays, unless they happen to be lucky enough to be signed to major labels, but that's so rare now. You know, it must have been lovely for him to be working on the level of, you know, he was still kind of in the kind of what you could loosely term the folk scene, you know, but you know, and he was playing kind of, you know, relatively small venues. He wasn't ever a huge name, you know. But you could get on a label at that stage without being a huge name, just by being a good musician. And then you had the freedom to just devote yourself to just playing music and nothing else. You didn't have to do your own booking. You didn't have to do your own PR. You didn't have to do your own, you didn't even have a website. But if you had a website, you wouldn't have had to update it yourself or your social media and all that stuff. And now I think being a musician, you have to do all this other stuff as well, and try and find time for music. You know, it's a real struggle. Like right now, I'm gearing up for the album release. I'm trying to spend, you know, a good couple of hours a day rehearsing my set for the album launch, but it's really hard to find the time for it because I'm also trying to deal with the pre-orders and the press copies and shipping out CDs to press and folding T-shirts. I was folding T-shirts this morning for the people who pre-ordered albums with T-shirts. You know, Michael Chapman never had to fold a T-shirt. You know, but having said that, so that's the downside of it. But the upside of it is, of course, that you can do it and you can get out there and do it, and you can take a risk that maybe a record company wouldn't have taken. A record company would want to be really sure of what they're putting out there. They'd want to be absolutely positive you were going to go out there and sell lots of records before they'd sign you. So whereas you as an artist can kind of gamble that there's an audience for what you do. So you can do something, you can be a lot more innovative and do stuff that maybe there isn't as much precedent for. I think record companies these days, especially, you know, it's tough for them, and you can't blame them. They want to play it safe. They want to take on sure things. They don't want to take risks.
Yeah, absolutely. But the whole thing is, yeah, very like DIY punk rock sort of thing. But, you know, kind of going off the punk rock thing a little bit, I'm always really into the get in the van sort of tour stories, you know, like the Black Flag show's gone awry type of thing. So I imagine you're gearing up tour dates. Are there any like notable tour stops that stick out to you? Not even negative necessarily, but just memorable in scope on some level?
Oh, let me think. Well, there was the time in East Germany when we got we went over on tour to Germany and we had in March, and we had neglected to put winter tires on the van.
Oh no.
And there was major snow and major ice. And they're pretty good about clearing roads of snow and ice there. But I had a gig in East Germany. It was mad because, another aspect of touring at my level is, you know, I don't have, like, local record company staff coming to the venues with me and, you know, dealing with everything. So neither myself nor my tour manager speaks German. and nobody in this place spoke English. So we were kind of referring to Google Translate on the phone and everything like that, you know, and trying to communicate with people. And it was a great gig, fantastic gig, a place called Mall's House in Plauen, right on the Czech border, about as far east as you can get in Germany. And as the gig was finishing, as we were loading out, we saw the snow starting to fall. And in the morning, I had to drive to Munich. We had to drive to Munich the next day, and the roads were just covered with ice, and we had to get started. We couldn't kind of wait for the roads to be cleared, or so we thought. Anyway, we should have waited for the roads to be cleared. So we set off, and we had to drive up a hill, and the hill was completely covered with ice. And as we were driving up this hill, the van sort of went sideways and started sliding backwards down the hill.
Oh, no.
And my tour manager always laughs when he tells the story. He said he saw me get my phone out, and he thought, oh, you know, maybe Sarah's, I don't know, ringing ahead to tell the next venue we're going to be delayed or something, or, you know, or ringing for, you know, roadside assistance or something. And no, what I actually did was I phoned home to talk to my husband, and I said, I just wanted to say, you know, I love you. I was afraid I was going to die, you know, and I just wanted to call home and make sure I spoke to my husband before I died. But I didn't die, fortunately. But Martin always laughed, you know, because he never had any, you know, the van was sliding backwards down an icy, hilly road, but, you know, he never had any notion that we were actually, I thought we were going to flip over and start rolling down the hill and crash and burn and all the rest. And he said, no, you know, it was just sliding slowly down the hill. There was never any real danger. So, but we did eventually fetch up against a barrier and had to sit there and wait until the road got clear enough to drive on. Some very nice people who had a house nearby came out and rolled out carpet and tried to help us move it and stuff like that. And it took ages, though, before we could actually get the van moved. But meanwhile, all this communication was going on, you know, with my sort of me looking up Google Translate on my phone and trying to say stuff. And they kept saying, Polizei, Polizei. And I knew enough German to know that Polizei meant police, and they were pointing at the towers, and it took a while, but I finally figured out what they were trying to say was that it was actually illegal in winter not to have winter tires on a van, and if the police were to come along, we were going to be in big trouble for driving around without winter tires and having to pull over to the side of the road and all the rest. So, but anyway, that didn't happen. And we got on the road again, and we made it safely to Munich. But that was the one time I've been out touring and actually thought I was about to die.
I guess it's funny to look back on. In the moment, probably not so much, but now you can probably...
Oh, no, in the moment, it was terrifying. I've never been so terrified.
You didn't really encounter that so much when you were a kid there touring with the Chicago Children's Choir. You didn't really get the icy roads in Canada so much on those tours?
No, I don't recall any icy road issues. I recall icy road issues traveling with my parents, you know, in the car. I remember one time, I think it was on the road between Chicago and Indiana, and we wound up in a ditch full of snow, along with several other cars, all went down into the ditch at the same time. But luckily, we didn't hit each other. But no, with the choir, everything... In my recollection, the main issue with the choir was a lot of the time we had to do television tapings, you know, for like local TV stations and stuff, and they'd always have these really bright lights, and the choir uniform was a turtleneck, a white turtleneck shirt and a red blazer jacket. And the blazer jacket was pretty thick, and you had this turtleneck around your neck, so you got pretty, and a long sleeve, it was a long sleeved turtleneck shirt and a blazer jacket, so you'd be really hot, and then you'd have these TV lights on you, and you'd get really hot, and somebody would always faint. There was a bit of, I never fainted, but people around me would be fainting, but the thing to do, if somebody fainted, was, you know, sort of grab them under the shoulders, but keep singing. Don't stop singing. If somebody faints, just keep singing, smile, pretend nothing's happening. You know, people would be dropping around you, and you'd just be singing and smiling. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. But we've been kind of touching on the record here, the new one, and I want to get a little in deep with it. If we dig any deeper, it could get dangerous. It drops February 2nd, and I want to talk about some of the tracks here. Break Me Down, I think, is an interesting track because there's a certain juxtaposition at play. It was described as the cheeriest song ever written about decomposition, so I'm kind of wondering how that track came about.
Yeah, well, it was on my mind, you know. I was thinking about... I was reading about how cremation is actually really bad for the environment because it releases all kinds of noxious gases, and I thought I'd be cremated, you know, but apparently it's not so good being cremated. Apparently the most environmentally friendly way of disposing of your body after you die is to be buried in some kind of, you know, well, either without a coffin or in some kind of biodegradable coffin made out of wicker or wood or, you know, cardboard or whatever, and just, you know, decompose and degrade. And there's actually a movement afoot to actually compost people, which I think is fantastic. I think there's a place in Seattle that does it, but nowhere over here in England. But so the sort of ecological burial is kind of the next best thing. And I was thinking about that and thinking about how I really like the idea of kind of coming full circle and, you know, and having your death provide, you know, nourishment for other plants that are going to grow up above you. And it's kind of rejoining the circle of life or something without sounding too kind of airy-fairy about it. So I wrote Break Me Down. But I was very conscious when I wrote Break Me Down that I wanted it to be upbeat. I didn't want it to be dirge-like or mournful or anything like that. It was an idea. The idea was to try and look at, not look at death in a happy way exactly, but look at what happens when you die. When you've died, you're rejoining the earth, returning to the earth, and I think that's kind of a lovely idea, really. Although I'm not in any hurry to do it.
Yeah.
Which is why I was so freaked out on that icy road in East Germany.
Yeah, really.
wasn't ready. I'm definitely not ready to return to the earth just yet. I want lots more years of life.
Yeah, we need a lot more great records out of you, and you need to keep having all these cool experiences you're talking about. But another song I was interested in was One Sparrow Down. Now, you're really known for the dadgad-tuned guitar, but it seemed like this track was kind of unorthodox in a sense because certain percussion instruments like wine bottle, oven grill used in the track. So kind of like, I guess, an avant-garde type of a track for you there. What inspired that track and what kind of compelled you to maybe do something using those kind of unorthodox percussion instruments?
Well, I had the idea for the song, first of all, because quite literally, you know, I had this little bird. We've got a big kind of plate glass window in our kitchen, and this bird was just throwing himself at the window, and meanwhile our cat was sitting inside and just watching the whole thing and kind of licking her. You know how when cats can see a bird outside and they start chattering? Just like that, you know? And she was like, yum, you know? And now... It didn't actually happen in reality the way I describe it in the song. I think the bird just got tired and flew off after a while, but I decided to take, you know, poetic license and make it more dramatic and have the bird actually die at the end. But I thought it was a really good metaphor about xenophobia, kind of, and fear of the unknown and how this little bird, he sees his own reflection in the window, and he's attacking it because he thinks it's a foreign bird. It's out, you know, it's out to get him. It's going to take over his territory, and he's got to attack it and drive it away. And he doesn't realize who he's actually attacking is himself. He's not hurting anybody but himself. And meanwhile, there's the cat who the little sparrow can't even see, and the cat is watching the whole thing and just going, ha ha, I'm just going to take advantage of this situation any way I can, you know. So it's all a little bit of a political, societal metaphor, but I try and, I always try and keep my, keep things on a very kind of implicit level. I don't like to preach at people, but I just thought it was a really good kind of way of seeing that situation. And then as I was writing the song, I thought it would be really nice just as an a cappella song. But then I thought it could use some percussion, and it was when we went into the studio to record it that Michael Chapman was saying, hey, you know, I think we should really, like, get lots of different weird percussion, you know, and he was the one who he went off. We were recording in this shed that we converted to a studio for the recording, and there's all this stuff that had been in the shed that had been kind of shunted to the back of it so that we could set up our makeshift studio in the front of it. And he went off to the back and came out with this old like tabletop oven. Like not a microwave, but an actual oven, like for camping or something like that. I don't know, it's like a camping, portable oven anyway. And he came out and he was taking it apart and clanking on bits of it and going, ah, here we go. And he pulled out, I think I've got a photograph of it, on my website somewhere of him actually pulling out the grill and running a drumstick across it to show what he meant. And an empty wine bottle got pressed into service. So it became this nice kind of clanky, thing. So to do that live, I got a crash course in playing the drum, just one drum, not a drum kit, but Roger, who played drum kit on the album, he actually came over to my house just a couple of weeks ago to give me a drum lesson, and he's loaned me a tom drum that he's not using at the moment, so I've just got that drum on a stand, and I play that, I'll be playing that on Thursday when we launch the album at the gig. So, never ever played the drums in my life before. But, you know, there's a first time for everything.
Yeah, that's cool. Seems like you're having a lot of new additions in there. Piano is something you're kind of bringing in there with the track "The Silence Above Us." So, why did the piano also feel like an element you wanted to, you know, bring to the table on this record?
Well, that was actually that came from my manager. He'd been saying for ages to me, you know, you should try writing something on the piano, because he knew I played piano just for fun, not to perform on, and he kept saying, oh, you should write something on the piano, and I'd always kind of hesitated to do it, partly because I like guitar, and partly because I just thought, oh, it wouldn't be practical to have to tour with a keyboard, but that's exactly what we're going to do now, because I finally did write that one piece on the piano, and it sounded so nice that we decided to try and tour a piano, and again, and I've been so lucky with the instruments being loaned to me. I've got the drum on loan from Roger. I've got Michael Chapman's electric guitar on long-term loan from him. And a friend of mine up in Scotland messaged that I posted on Facebook saying, anybody know of a good stage piano going for sale cheap, you know, with the whole full-length keyboard and weighted keys and stuff, because I wanted that full-length keyboard. And he said he had a Roland stage piano that he wasn't using, so he UPS'd it down to me. So we're going to be touring with that. So I'll be playing piano in public for the first time ever in my life on Thursday as well, and electric guitar. So three new instruments.
Yeah, is that something that keeps you creatively inspired? Just bringing these new instruments to the table. Not that you'd be lacking inspiration if you were to just, you know, stick to guitar, but does it kind of just like, I guess, broaden your expressive wheelhouse to try these different instruments on as well?
Yeah, it totally opens up a whole new universe of possibilities of sounds. I mean, like the electric guitar was a real revelation, and I owe that to Michael. I'd always been kind of a bit of a guitar snob, you know. I played the acoustic guitar, and that's a beautiful handmade, custom-made instrument, and that's all I need or want. And then I was staying at Michael Chapman's house during one of my tours, and he handed me this electric guitar and said, I want to hear you playing this, play this. And if anybody else but Michael Chapman had handed me an electric guitar and said, play this, I would have said no thank you, but, you know, it was him, so I said, okay, you know, and I started playing it and kind of twiddling the knobs on the amp to see what sounds I could get out of it, and it was just a eureka moment, really. It was kind of like, oh, wow, oh, I can do this, oh, I can do this, you know. And the four songs on the album that are on, where I play the electric guitar, all of those, well, three songs and one instrumental piece, the Day of Wrath that day, all of those came out of that guitar. I wouldn't have written those if I hadn't had that electric guitar to write them on, because they're kind of direct consequences of the sounds that I could make with the guitar. So it's really opened me up creatively. It's been amazing. I mean, I still love the acoustic guitar, and I'll always play that as well, and I'll keep writing on that. But it's just nice to have more tools, you know, more tools, more toys.
Yeah, for sure. And you're talking about just being inspired by certain things like that. And I thought it was interesting how, you know, the album title was inspired. You were kind of just giving your son a warning when he was digging like a big hole in the back garden sort of thing. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. He'd been out there digging for a few days, you know, like lots of boys who like to go out and dig things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't really paying, sorry?
No, I said, yeah, I mean, I was kind of that, I'm still kind of that guy. Like, I'm in northern Alberta, and when I go ice fishing with my buddies, I'm like, can I make the hole?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a boy thing. It's definitely a male thing. My daughter didn't have any interest in digging holes in the garden. But yeah, he was out there, and I wasn't really kind of monitoring the situation too closely, and I finally thought, you know what, I should probably go out there and see what he's doing, and I went out, and it wasn't a hole, it was an excavation. He was up in over his head in this hole in the ground. And I just, Eli, if you dig any deeper, it could get dangerous. And I heard myself say it, and I thought, there's a song. And again, like with the sparrow, just the shades of metaphorical meaning just immediately hit me that, lots of different levels in that one, because, I mean, the first thought that came to mind was fracking and how dangerous that is, and then also I was thinking on a more metaphorical level, the other shades of meaning of dig, when you're dealing with friends or colleagues, or when you're, or even just in your own, within your own head, sometimes it's not good to dig too deep, you know, sometimes it's good to kind of back off and let situations resolve themselves and, you know, stop digging. So I just really liked all the different shades of meaning that you could draw out of that one sentence. I do that a lot with songs, that a lot of the time it's just a phrase that either I hear myself say or I hear somebody else say, and I thought, ooh, that could mean lots of things, you know.
Yeah, and it's really cool because it's so organic, and you're not necessarily, like, sitting down and it's like, okay, I'm going to think of something poignant to put together here. You're just kind of going about your day, and then all of a sudden you say something or you observe something, and it's just like, that's it. I'm going to run with this.
Yeah, and usually it's not particularly poignant to begin with. I mean, like, well, you know, I've already talked about how I came up with the phrase of, if we dig any deeper, but the other track, the piano track you mentioned earlier, The Silence Above Us, the actual phrase, The Silence Above Us, is something, again, I heard myself say it, but what I was talking about was how since we got the cat, we didn't seem to have so many rats and mice scampering around up in the attic. Usually standing in the bedroom, you'd hear all these little scratchings and squeakings and skitterings above your head, and I was like, yes, really nice, the silence above us. And again, it was just the phrase struck me, and
yeah.
And that one, I immediately discarded the original meaning of that one, and it became a song about standing outside at night in the cold in the winter and looking up at the sky and the stars and thinking about stuff and feeling and shivering and looking at all that, and it's night, and all the, you know, the bushes are rustling, the small birds are settling, just kind of trying to capture that moment of standing out there. But standing out there is not what I was doing when I first said The Silence Above Us. I was talking about rats.
That's really interesting, too, though. I dig that. But I also wanted to talk about the dadgad sort of guitar experience you have. I sort of alluded to that earlier on in the conversation, but you've written a book about it. You've, you know, established some workshops with that, which I think is really cool. I'm just kind of wondering, though, like, how it informed your playing ability? Because I've had certain situations where I've tried to, you know, tutor someone or teach someone something, and I learned so much more just by virtue of, like, trying to articulate it aloud to them. So I'm wondering if you've had similar, you know, learning experiences by teaching people these different dad-gad techniques.
Well, certainly, I mean, when I've been experimenting with open tunings pretty much all for years, you know, starting when I was like 14, and I used to listen to a lot of the Wyndham Hill artists, people like Michael Hedges and Alex Degrassi and Willie Ackerman, and they were always using open tunings and tuning their guitars different ways, and so I used to just randomly tune my guitar different ways and see what sounds I could make. And then it was actually when I was studying in France for a year when I was 18, and I was asking around, was there any band that needed a singer-guitarist? And there was this trad Irish band that was looking for a singer-guitarist, and so I liked the music, and I started playing with them. And then we were playing at a festival, and a French guy came up to me, and he said, you know, the kind of music you're playing, all the Irish traditional players, they're all using the dad-gad tuning. And I said, what's that? D-A-D-G-A-D. So I just tuned my guitar to dad-gad and tried, you know, putting my fingers randomly on the strings to see what sounds I could make. And it was just like a, again, kind of a eureka moment, kind of a, this is what I've been looking for. Because I was really into Led Zeppelin, and I really apparently, Jimmy Page actually used dad-gad quite a lot, and he used it on Cashmere, you know, and various others. And, you know, so, I was like, that's how you make that sound, you know, and all of a sudden I could play, you know, all these songs that I'd really liked. But once I started experimenting more with dad-gad, and actually I think it was kind of the process of writing the book about it, where I was looking for dad-gad versions of pretty much every chord, that I realized that you didn't have to play in a particular style if you were playing in dad-gad. It's just a different way of tuning the guitar, and you can, I mean, I still do everything in dad-gad. It's become my standard tuning, and I use it for all of the songs that I write and all of the songs that I cover. And you know, as you can hear from the album, it doesn't sound like a tuning. It's just somebody playing the guitar. But I just love the richness of it. And yeah, giving workshops, I always say that I always feel like I learn something new pretty much every workshop I give, just from people asking questions and some of those people make suggestions or, you know, tell me something that they've figured out. So it's a really good thing to do.
Yeah, that's really cool, for sure. But you've been really great with your time. I don't want to take up your whole afternoon here. I'm sure we could talk for a while, but is there anything you wanted to add as we're wrapping up here?
No, just if you can include a link to the website and all that kind of thing, that would be fantastic. Do you have my email address?
I have Howard's email address. I don't believe I have yours, though.
Okay, let me just check that I think he sent me yours, and I'll send you a quick email. I'll send you a quick email, and then if you could, let's see, Dylan, let me see if I can find it quickly. It was in interview schedule. Here it is. So it is... Dylan.Boker478@gmail.com. That's you, is it?
Yep, that's correct.
Great. So I'll send you an email, and then if you can send me a link when this goes out, I can put it up on social media and all that stuff. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, I could definitely do that, and I would super appreciate that. But I'm thinking people are going to appreciate this record when it drops February 2nd. Shuffle and a Spade Records putting it out. Everyone has to check out the new Sarah McQuaid. I was really digging what I heard, and the record, very fittingly, is called If We Dig Any Deeper, It Could Get Dangerous. But thanks for your time. A lot of great insights, and hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Dylan. Lovely, lovely talking to you. And, yeah, it's sarahmcquaid.com, SarahMcquaid.com.